can't find that on the radio.
Well, tune in to WBSign.com to ensure that the transmitter, $1,000 a month, is a tower phone 212 to future.
Hey, 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 hey.
Thank you, tribute and portioner sponsored radio station.
The time now is 2:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Ecologic. This is WBAI New York 99.2.
Water, our healthy air and water. Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein, and this is Ecologic for December 10th, 2021.
When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
New, exciting, and more efficient solar technologies are on the horizon.
We have a professor in the chemistry department of the University of Massachusetts Amherst to tell you what we can expect going forward.
Welcome to Ecologic, Professor.
Well, hi, Ken. Thank you for having me. So I work in the area of materials chemistry and here in the chemistry department at UMass. And for the past about 5 years or so, we've been looking at new technologies for solar energy conversion.
Well, how is solar cell technology changing, and why is change needed?
Yeah, it's a great question. So silicon has been the dominant technology. That's the one that you see in everybody's rooftops, and the technology that came out, 50s and 60s, and the efficiency of that has largely not changed. But you can also see that there are a couple of, it's a very mature technology, but also has some things that we need to work on. One is it's a very thick, system. And so, people have been looking at, are there other technologies that can be very thin, that can actually work very efficiently like silicon, but also can they be processed in a way that's much energy efficient, right? So silicon requires a very high temperature to actually process. So there's a lot of interest actually in developing technologies where you could probably print using, let's say, an inkjet printer, And that's how, these are the things that actually are motivating us to look at some new technologies, particularly the one that recently has been very exciting, which is the perovskite technology.
Print on an inkjet printer like what everybody has at home?
Yeah, so these are inks that one can make and print very easily using things like inkjet printer that you have at home, yeah.
Wow. I mean, this is amazing. So this can be done, I mean, right now, there's a lot of people worried about all the rare earth elements in traditional silicon cells coming from China, and now we can't get them anymore. And now you're talking about solar cells that you can print at home.
Wow.
Right.
You mentioned perovskites. What is that a key to what we're talking about here?
Yeah, so if you take a silicon cell, the part that actually does all the work, that absorbs the light, that then converts that light into energy, is silicon. So this is what, you know, in the jargon we call it active layer, right? So it's active because it's actually absorbing light, and then it's the film that actually does all the work. So the when you say perovskite solar cell, it means that we have replaced silicon with this compound called perovskite. And that's why these are called perovskite solar cells, meaning that they are just the active layer in these systems.
You sent us a picture of perovskites, and it looks like a lattice, almost like the crystal of a silicon solar cell. But it looks like the electrons are in a different spot than they are in silicon. So I guess that is what makes them so efficient.
Yes, in the broader sense, yes, and it also is because of the way the atoms actually are arranged. They actually impart some electronic characters that actually also make them really good.
Oh. And
so they absorb very well in the solar spectrum. Then when they absorb, then they can actually move the charges also very efficiently. And it turns out one of the major things about this particular molecule is they can actually absorb a lot of light in a very thin layer, right? That's why we can actually make a very thin solar cell compared to silicon, which does require a thick layer to absorb the light.
What's the difference? What's the difference between the thick and the thin?
So if you take a light and you actually send through a material, the light actually will interact with electrons, and then if there's an energy match between the lights coming in and where the electrons actually are, then they can actually, you know, get the energy from the light. So it turns out the way the physics work is that in the case of the normal solar spectrum, the ability of this material to absorb light in perovskite is really good. And so all you need is a very thin material that can actually absorb a lot of light. Whereas in silicon, because of the way the electrons actually are, for the visible spectrum, it requires a lot of material to absorb the same amount of light. So that's the difference between a thick cell and a thin cell.
I'm seeing all kinds of applications in my mind. What about you can use this on in clothing? You can wear it on your hat and your jacket when you go out, and your cell phone will go on forever. Is it really that malleable?
Well, I'm not sure the cell phone can go on forever, but yes, you're right. It is exciting that because you can make a thin film. And in fact, it also can be semi-transparent, meaning that you can see through, right? So one can imagine applications beyond just the rooftops. One can imagine putting it on, you know, on a coffee table, on curtains, and also on textiles or clothing, as you said. One of my colleagues here at UMass, Trisha Andrew, her lab, the V-Lab, is actually trying to figure out methods to make fabric that can actually, you know, convert, you know, energy. So it's exciting, yeah.
I'm thinking of my parents' passive solar south-facing windows, which if they had those solar collectors on the floor in the living room, wow.
How about wrapping a whole building in the material combined with passive house technology? That would be, like, amazing.
And even a little more practical, and those rooftop panels that older buildings can't support could be a lot thinner, and you've got to open up a lot more rooms.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And one can imagine even the shingles actually made of these materials. So they're actually thin, you know, and they can go on rooftops very easily and they're lightweight. Exactly.
How does once you have the material, how does it attach to what you are using? Do you have to have wires that attach from the perovskite material cells to something?
Yeah, it's like building imagine you're actually building like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, right? You have a bread, and then you have to put the peanut butter on, and you put the jelly on, and then you put the second bread, right? So similarly, in this case, the bread actually are like electrodes. So they are the edges of the cell. And then you put, you know, a couple of layers. And so in this case, we put a layer that actually can take, electrons, and then we put the perovskite, and we put another layer that actually can take what are called holes, and then you put the second bread on top of it. That's your structure that you make, and then you connect the wires to the bread. And so when the light comes in and hits the perovskite or any active material, you know, the electrons get excited, and they go to the electrodes, and then they're taken out, and then they go to the circuit. Yes.
If they're so thin, are they easily damaged, or are they pretty robust?
That's a great question. So in the case of normally, you know, we put it on a planar structure, they're okay. But there are researchers now, there's a group in Stanford looking at what are called flexible electronics, which is like if you do actually flex these systems really a lot, what can we do to the material in such a way that the damage is not there, right?
Oh my God.
And so there are a lot of technologies that are being looked at that allows us to actually make flexible electronic materials, which will not, be damaged when you actually bend them or do what you want to do with them. Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, then looking at it from another angle, is there any problem of it? The fact that it doesn't break down, is there any environmental problem when it's discarded, or will it maybe never be discarded? How does that work?
That's a good question. So one of the reasons why this technology is not, on your rooftops yet, actually, is it does break down a little faster than what we want them to. Mm-hmm. So actually, we are working on the other side to make them a little more stable than you know, what they are now, right? But also, I must say that there are a lot of research that's going on looking at these systems, not, just at the device perspective, but looking at, let's say, where do we get the materials for these systems? Once you make the material and then we discard them, what happens to these materials, right? So there's a whole amount of research that's going on looking at the life cycle, actually, of these materials. And something also which is interesting is that how do you deploy these materials? Where do you deploy them, right? And so some of the research questions that need to be asked, we're asking them too in terms of, you know, how do you actually deploy in a very just way these materials? So there's a lot of work that's being done on these kind of systems. Look at not only just the science part of it, but also the supply chain part of it, and what happens when at the end of the life, what happens to these devices.
How far are we from having these on our roofs and our cars and in our clothes?
An optimist would say about 5 years. And so that's because there are a lot of progress. By the way, I must tell you this, right? This material, the way we are using it now, came actually onto the scene only in 2012. So this is actually what you're looking at, about a 10-year progress. That's enormous progress, right? So there are a lot of companies that already started looking into these systems to make them commercial. Oxford PV in the UK, Tandem PV here in Colorado, Energy Materials actually in Rochester, New York. So there are really good companies looking into bringing to the market as quickly as possible. So optimists would say about 5 to 7 years. We are still looking at, as I told you before, we're starting with this material a little bit less stable than where we want them to be. And so it depends upon how the chemistry actually takes over and how to make these materials more stable.
We want it now.
A little bit earlier, so.
I remember reading about this in Science News magazine many years ago, and I had to sort of pull myself back from doing a show about it right away, because things on the drawing board may be on the drawing board for a very long time. And then I started hearing about it again in other sources. So I realized that there must be an awful lot of people working on this all over the world, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and particularly after 2015, There's a lot of effort going on into this because, just to give you an idea, we have been actually in this area for a while, but I would say this technology is not, I mean, among other technologies, right, this is the one that's most exciting. Following this also is another technology called the organic photovoltaics, where instead of perovskite, they actually use, like, dye molecules, like, you know, polymers that actually can absorb light, too. And that's also, you know, the last few years actually have done really well. They've actually gone to, what, 18% efficient systems, which is you know, close to where silicon actually is, right? So these developments that are happening in the last few years, and yeah, you're right, a lot of people are working on this.
Are those mostly for-profit companies working on it, or universities, research facilities?
Both, and in fact, a large amount of research actually is done in the universities, actually.
Mm-hmm. I guess we're really curious to know how this can ramp up. Can it replace a gas-powered plant? That's what we really want to do. Can we really ramp it up to the level of
utility
all
scale,
the energy that an area needs?
That's a great question. So as I told you before, I mentioned about inkjet printing, right? So you can, these are actually inks that we formulate in the lab. You take the materials, you dissolve it in some solvent, and you just print them. That's how you do this, right? So this is like any printing technology that you can actually have. This is called the roll-to-roll printing. And so the beauty of this approach actually is that you can scale them very nicely because they can be printed in large areas, right? That's one of the major advantages of this. So yes, it can be scaled up efficiently. In fact, there is a group at North Carolina that's really working on how to print these materials in a large way without losing a lot of the efficiency.
Wow.
Are you in constant communication with other people who are studying this?
Yes. Yeah. We there's a conference that happens actually twice a year, and we go to these conferences, and then when papers get published, we talk to each other about it, and there's a lot of excitement going on in the materials. Yeah. There's also a little competition as to who's doing what, and whether we get there first and they get there first. And so.
Well, if it's any evidence by how excited we are all talking to you and how excited our listeners are from the promotions that we've been doing, that keep going.
Right, I think it's great that networking is happening, because sometimes in science, people are competing. They're competing for prizes or grants or whatever. And it sounds like you're competing to get the best result faster because you want to get the best result faster.
Yes, exactly right. And also, you know, there are some grant agencies that now, ask us to think about, like, what are we going to do? It's not just basic science. Ask us to think about, okay, if this succeeds, then what are we going to do next with it? Are we going to partner with people? Are ourselves going to start, these kind of manufacturing things, right? So in some sense, everybody actually is looking at this and saying, okay, how do we bring this technology to the users as quickly as we can?
And one thing that's really near and dear to us is, how can we bring it to the public without someone or some organization somewhere grabbing profit? How can we get it to as many people as possible without regulations that will create some monopoly or somebody keeping it from people? The powers that be do not want cheap energy out there. So how are you protecting yourself from being controlled?
That's a good question. So most of the research is coming out in journals now that's open access, right? So like people can access some of these papers, and they know how we manufacture them and so on and so forth. I'm pretty sure that there are a couple of tricks that people may use that they want to keep it a little bit secret, that because of the competitive edge they may have, like one person here, one person there, efficiency. But I would say, in general, the literature actually is open. It's not done in secret. It's all shared openly, and so Many federal agencies now require us to actually publish these things and open, you know, provide open access to some of the literature. So public does have access to the literature very well. So anyway, that's the answer to the question, is that it's not done in secret. It's actually done openly. People know what's going on. And that's what the fun part of it all is, too. So.
Yeah, I've read one of your papers online. And you're talking about organic thin film solar and things like that. You were one of several different authors. So clearly there's a wonderful team going on there.
Right.
And I'll put a link to your paper on our website as soon as the show is over. It does... You know, when you do an environmental show, you get so much bad news that you have to tell people about, and it's wonderful to tell people good news like this. You really feel optimistic about the future, long range.
Yeah, and absolutely right, and that's also what excites us, because these things can actually make a huge difference in the way we generate energy now.
So 5 years, that's 2026. So by 2030, and everybody seems to be pointing to 2030 as the magic year. Either we lower our greenhouse gas emissions or, you know, we're kind of doomed as a thriving species. And it sounds like you're right in that wheelhouse.
Yeah, and Ken, we should probably talk again in 2026 and see where we are.
That's a great idea. It's a date.
Well, look, as usual, the time flies by and we really need to wrap it up. I'm sorry, but thanks for joining us, everybody. For more information, you can reach DV at dvgroup.umasscreate.net. That's dvgroup.umasscreate, that's one word, .net. Join us next week, December 17th at 2:30 p.m. to hear about a holiday climate justice occupation near President Biden's home in Wilmington, Delaware, December 25th through January 1st.
To get environmental news on a variety of topics, such as the latest developments with East River Park and the daylighting with Tibbetts Brook, and to listen to this show again or any of our past shows, go to www.ecoradio.org. That's www.ecoradio.org.
And congratulations to everyone fighting for East River Park, because the court awarded a restraining order on the destruction. Hear more by going to our website. If you didn't get around to donating for our premiums on our fundraising show last week, we would really appreciate it if you do so now. We were told no pledges were made last week, but some of you said you were going to, so please pledge and also join our email list so you can tell us. All the Ecologic premiums are available on give2wbai.org. Do a search for Eco-Logic. We know you want us on the air. Please show us.
You can help us to keep WBAI alive and healthy and Ecologic on the air. WBAI is making a year-end push to pay for our transmitter rental. Donating to the Transmitter Tower Fund helps every single show on the station. Go to www.towerfund.wbai.org, where you can find all the details. Help keep this listener-supported station on the air. Call 212-209-2950 or go to towerfund.wbai.org. Pledging now during this show really helps Ecologic specifically.
Also, those of you online, please sign up for our email list to stay connected with us. Those of you on social media, please search for Eco-Logic.
And congratulations to Stephen Donziger being released to home confinement.
Although Julian Assange was cleared for extradition.
And thanks to our terrific engineer, Reggie Johnson, we couldn't do this without you.
I'm Ken Gale.
I'm Sally Gellert.
And I'm Donna Stein. Join us December 17th at 2:30 p.m. to hear about the climate justice occupation. Here comes
WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad. Here are some headlines. Prices rose to a nearly 40-year high by 6.8% compared with a year ago, as inflation continues to complicate the political environment for Congress and the White House. Data released today by the Bureau of Labor Statistics showed that prices rose 0.8% in November compared with October, with inflation spreading throughout the economy, including to areas that had not been previously hurt by the pandemic. Indexes for gasoline, shelter, food, used cars, trucks, and new vehicles were among the large contributors. Airline fares also increased. Also, rents have been climbing, influenced by soaring home prices. Today's inflation report showed rent was up 0.4% in November compared with October. Meanwhile, with pandemic-related relief either dwindling or gone, and COVID cases continuing to rise, consumer debt is increasing. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York's Center for Microeconomic Data reports that credit card balances jumped by $17 billion. To $800 billion in the third quarter of this year. The rise in credit card debt reverses the pandemic trend that saw consumers spending less and paying down their balances. The Supreme Court said today that Texas abortion providers may sue to stop the state's ban on most abortions after 6 weeks, but left the law in place for now. The decision allows the providers to return to a district judge who once blocked the law, saying it violated the constitutional right to abortion. That restarts the legal process that has let the law remain in effect since September 1st, when the Supreme Court refused to step in to block it. Today, 8 justices said the abortion providers may bring the challenge. A federal appeals court unanimously rejected twice impeached one-term former President Donald Trump's effort to block a House committee from getting White House records related to the January 6th Capitol riot. A 3-judge panel for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals said Trump had given them no reason to override President Biden's decision not to invoke executive privilege to keep the documents secret. The panel gave the former president 14 days to ask the Supreme Court to review the decision before the National Archives begins turning over the records to the committee. At least 53 people are dead after a cargo truck filled with migrants overturned and crashed in southern Mexico. Mexican authorities said at least 105 others were injured. The crash happened in Chiapas State, near the Guatemalan border. According to the Associated Press, as many as 200 migrants were believed to be in the trailer when it flipped and struck the bottom of a pedestrian bridge. This year, at least 650 people have died trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border, more than in any other year since the agency began documenting deaths in 2014. In what some are calling a wave of labor activism, Starbucks workers have just won a landmark bid to form their first union today in Buffalo, New York. Shift, Shaft, and baristas in one store in Buffalo voted to unionize in a 19-8 decision. The Starbucks in Elmwood Village will be the only unionized Starbucks in the country among 9,000 corporate-owned stores. Currently in Washington, it's partly sunny and 52 degrees. In New York, it's cloudy and 46. I'm Askia Muhammad. Thank you for listening to WPFW Washington and WBAI New York.
Stay tuned for On the Ground.